Welcome to the Nui Tech People podcast. My name is James McDonald. I spend my days interviewing some of the most innovative people working in the tech industry and hear some amazing stories. Each fortnight, we release a new episode sharing these conversations. This podcast aims to showcase the tech projects happening right here in Newcastle, provide key resources to help you grow your tech career, and share insights into the future of the Newcastle tech scene. Hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to another episode of Nui Tech People. On today's episode, I interview Tom Howard from the Greater Bank. Really insightful for me to hear how they've taken inspiration from the Marines in building their software development teams. Hope you find this episode insightful. Welcome to another episode of Nui Tech People. Today we have Tom Howard, QA lead and lean coach at the Greater Bank. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
For those that don't know who you are, can you give people a bit of an overview of who you are, what you're currently working on?
Yep. So I'm currently working on the digital transformation project at the Greater Bank as their QA lead and lean coach. So basically helping the developers maintain a high level of quality, make sure we get good stuff through to production, and from a lean coach point of view, helping them with flow and delivering stuff fast.
Nice. I'm definitely keen to sort of dig into that, but let's try to explore how you got to that position, because it's not a extremely common position. How's your career span to date to get to where you are today?
Okay, so career span. So I actually started off as an AI developer back in the day, so working for the CSIRO.
Yeah.
From there, I moved into enterprise application integration using tool sets like TIBCO Rendezvous and TIBCO BusinessWorks. It was during that time that I found out that I was an agilist at heart, just didn't know it. And basically since then, I've been sort of moving more into learning about psychology, how people work, how my own mind works, and helping teams deliver faster.
Very nice. I love this whole psychology angle as well. I think technology in general, there's obviously the actual technology side of it, but understanding that human side of it is massive. Can you give a bit of it, your insights into either, understanding who you're building for or the actual creation of a team? I'm really interested to hear the psychology angle to that.
Well, for me, the tech stuff's easy.
Yeah.
Like there's, no insurmountable tech problems. It's just a matter of like nutting out and getting it done. The really hard stuff's the people. Yeah. Keeping them aligned, understanding their sort of biases and backgrounds and how their head works so that, you're not butting heads with them all the time. Helping show them how they can go faster, whereas sometimes a lot of the stuff's counterintuitive. Like you think, working as an individual, okay, I'm very productive, okay? If I'm working in a team, okay, I feel less productive because there's pause periods, without necessarily realizing that actually, as a team, we get stuff done faster. So individually, I'm less productive, but as a team, I'm more productive, but it feels like you're going slower. So it's really hard sort of breaking those sort of counterintuitive sort of perceptions of what fast means.
Yeah, nice. Has that then affected how you've built teams in the past and currently?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned before lean coach. My agile journey involved a lot of learning about lean and flow and that sort of stuff, but they don't talk a lot about teamwork. And it was actually through Anthony Murphy, one of the guys I worked with at AMP, where I learned a bit more about Scrum. And for me, there's a whole heap of rituals around Scrum that I don't prescribe to, but the core of it for me was the name, the thinking of a team of people in a scrum pushing the story over the line. And that's basically guided how we formed the teams at Greater Bank, where we have this fire team concept where basically four developers plus or minus work in a fire team, full stack capability within that team in order to get the story from start to finish and done.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of driven that.
How long have you been operating in that model for?
A bit over a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the first time you've built those smaller four-person teams?
Yeah, it was a very big experiment. Through my career, I've kind of done really well just by going to conferences, listening to podcasts, doing conference workshops, taking the stuff other people are doing and that's working well and applying it in the teams I work with.
Yeah.
So I'm tend to avoid trying something absolutely brand new because it's like, well, chance of you getting it right are like...
There's no need to reinvent the wheel, right?
Exactly, exactly. So we were having teamwork problems in the project. And so from some of the psychology books that I've been sort of listening to, I borrowed the sort of fighting concept from the Marines.
Yeah, right.
And thought we'd give that a go and see how it fares.
For those that don't know how the Marines build their teams and that fire team concept, can you provide a little bit more context? Because I think it's a really... it's a really unique approach that seems like it's got a lot of merit, and you're obviously having some success with it, but I don't think it's overly common yet. And I
don't know any other teams in IT that are using it.
Yeah.
But basically the fire team construct goes down to a sort of a rule that they have in Marines, which I read once, can no longer find a reference to.
Yeah.
So take it with a grain of salt. But basically it was the rule is that no one person should be in charge of more than three things.
Yeah.
So a fire team leader in a fire team is in charge of three teammates. A squad leader is in charge of three fire teams. A platoon leader is in charge of at most three squads. And that's how they build their hierarchy.
Yeah.
And that sort of for them keeps things manageable, creates a clear line of communication. And that's kind of what we modeled it on. So we've got the fire team leaders and fire team members.
Yeah.
And we have squads, which are headed up by a product owner, supporting staff like UX, architecture, BAs that work across two fire teams, and then the two fire teams within each of those squads.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. It's been operating for a bit over a year in that sort of environment.
Yeah, a bit over a year. We introduced it. We first trialed it. It's done well. We started off without fire team leaders because there was a lot of people really liked the flat structure that we had before.
Yeah.
But basically there was a need to create a sort of a leadership role within those teams to help sort of create alignment.
Yeah.
And so fire team leads in itself has probably been around for about, I think, 3 months. So that's relatively new. But that's going really well as well.
Yeah, I really like that. I really like the approach and the mindset from the actual greater bank to buy into trying something new like that. It's not too often that organizations, especially bigger or older organizations, actually move and jump into something new. So you've got to give I give a lot of props to the greater bank for actually buying into that. And it sounds like you're having a lot of success with it because I've spoken to a couple of people that work in those teams and they're really enjoying it and feel more productive.
Yeah, it's worked out really well. The sort of the moment for me where I knew we'd really nailed it was when one of the devs that had been there for 5+ years, we were talking about fire teams and he said that they'd been telling one of the new starters after he'd been there for 3 months that we'd ruined him for anywhere else, that everywhere else was going to be crap in comparison.
That's a good way to keep people, right?
Yeah.
You provide a really good environment that people don't want to leave. So, yeah, it's a really good story. You mentioned you're part of the digital transformation. Digital transformation's
buzzword.
It is a bit buzzword, but I think people around Newcastle understand that the Greater Bank have been investing in this digital transformation. A lot of people might not understand exactly what that is, but for those outside that might not know in as much detail, can you give people a bit of an insight into what you're working on?
Yep, cool. Firstly, I'd say it's a horribly overused term and means absolutely different things in different places. So at Greater Bank, basically what it means is that we're effectively rebuilding the bank on a new tech stack. But we're also transforming the ways of working. So very much try new things, experiment, focus on fast flow, and so that when we go GA or general availability with what we're working on at the moment, that we have the ability to move fast and put new features to the customers, test them, see if they work, see if they like them, see if they don't, but basically create that ability to make changes quickly and safely.
How long has the transformation been going on?
So officially kicked off April last year, and April this year we actually went into prod with a couple of select beta users.
Nice.
It's really nice. It's like to go from nothing to core banking, front end for web and for mobile app in 12 months. That's amazing. One of the developers, I remember, was saying like it's one of the first times he's seen something like that happen at the Grader, which is fantastic.
Very nice. Seems like you're building extremely capable teams there. When you're looking to hire into those teams, for I guess if we're talking to more junior people out there or people that are considering a move, what are the sort of traits you're looking for in building your?
Yeah, culture and team fit. Absolutely, first and foremost. Basically, we're in the first interview, we're really trying to suss out if they're going to work well in a team, if they're happy working in a team. And if not, it's like, yeah, it's not going to be the place for you. I know some really, really capable developers from previous roles that are just amazing the amount they can churn out, but they're solo artists. They're just heads down, do the work, and you get what you get, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
That's sort of the first thing that we sort of try to suss out is whether they've got that sort of team mentality.
Yeah.
And then I like to ask a couple of questions about, you know, who was there, ask them to tell me about their best peer or worst peers that they worked with, best managers and worst managers that they worked with, because that tells me a lot about what they aspire to be in terms of their best peer, what they try to avoid in terms of their worst peer, and how they like and dislike to be managed. So that's sort of what we focus on in the first interview, besides selling the role. If they don't want it, we don't want them.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the worst thing we can do is go through the hassle of hiring someone for them to, you know, sort of 3 months later saying, actually, I don't like what you're doing, or I don't like the culture or anything. Yep. But second interview is usually sort of almost a meet and greet with the fire team they're going to be working with.
Yeah.
So the fire team members interview them. They do a much better job of sussing out their tech creds. You know, sort of typical problem with developers, even myself, you know, you ask them how good they are and they'll tell you.
Correct.
So, yeah, they're much better at sort of sussing that out. But more importantly, they're good at determining whether they think that person's going to be a good fit for them.
Yeah, nice.
If there's, you know, good chemistry in that with the team, great. If there's not, then it's like probably like, well, who else is available?
Yeah, there's a couple of points you mentioned there which I really appealed to me. You mentioned the word selling the role.
Mm.
Software developers across the board at the moment are hard to come by, where there's definitely more roles and opportunities than there are quality candidates in that space. You mentioned you actually have to sell that role to them in that first stage and get people to actually want to buy into what you work.
Absolutely.
Has that always been the mentality for you? Has it been something you've experienced throughout your career? I think different industries view things different ways. There's other industries that have less roles yeah. And more candidates, but...
Obviously, no, I wouldn't say it's always been the way, but I can't remember when the flip happened but I think it's, you know, it's sort of an obvious thing that, you know, you've got a candidate that's applying, they're not the only place they're applying to.
Yeah.
So if you can't, you know, sort of make the role attractive to them, then they'll go elsewhere. Developer sort of experience is a really important thing. Previous role, I was working with Rabobank, and they were saying that they were having problems hiring in Netherlands when developers would come in and say, can I bring my own laptop? And they'd say no, and they'll just hop out and leave. Yeah. And say, not even interested. So, yeah, so we focused a lot on developer experience, remote working, you know, creating that culture of team with the fire teams and to make it a really, really great place to work.
Yeah, it's a really, I guess, refreshing approach because it's a changing landscape, and I think there's definitely a need for organizations to sell opportunities to software developers in general, because software developers especially good quality software developers are not without opportunity, right?
Yeah.
Not without options. So, mate, the other part you mentioned there, which really appeals to me, is the culture being the first point of call, the first priority, technical skills a second. I think in the technology game, especially not even software developers, but across the board, really good technology professionals are going to have to continue to learn and upskill anyway, right? The skills that they're coming into work on day one, if they're there for 5 years, are going to highly likely be evolving their skill set over time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, we're effectively an Angular and Kotlin shop at the moment. We've hired .NET developers.
Yeah.
Simply because we could go, they're a great team fit. We can see that they've got a capability to learn.
Yep.
And they've been guns.
Correct. And that's what I love that approach. I love that hiring for culture first and skills second, because skills can be learned, especially if you've got the right person that is keen.
Yeah.
So if you've got them, they want to be there. They're a good culture fit. They enjoy the team they're working with. They'll pick up the skills, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're even seeing a lot of cross-skilling within the fight teams now. So one of the teams, thinking of the Fighting Mongooses, they've all got names.
Yeah, right.
They had sort of a lot of single point sensitivity on the iOS development. So yep. It was primarily one person in the team who was doing iOS build and one person in the team doing back-end build, and they had two for doing web build. And so now one of the web guys is learning a lot of iOS and the other front-end guys are learning a lot of back-end so that they can actually support each other more in terms of getting the stories done.
Yeah, great approach again, not having a single point of failure again, really strong approach. I know a lot of the sort of the stronger tech teams I'm working with have that same approach. It's not that single point of failure, having somebody that can back up or a secondary skill set.
Well, the other thing is like it's almost necessary with the structure we created, because if, you know, sort of if someone wants to go on holiday, can't send the whole fire team on holiday.
Yeah.
So, and we've basically said to the fire teams, like, you sort yourselves out. Someone wants to take leave, we'll approve it. You just got to sort it out yourselves. So they talk about it themselves and make sure they're not going to leave their teammates in the lurch.
And yeah, nice. I really like, yeah, it's a lot of a team and a culture approach. Like they're the words that I'm hearing most from you rather than any technical capability or technical skills. If I swing that back to you, you would be considered post-technical these days.
Post-technical. That's not a term I've heard.
I guess from a career development perspective, yeah, people can come up, you come up the ranks in technology and you're obviously really technical, hands-on, and you can continue either down that sort of super technical route and become extremely senior from a technical perspective, or you start to do the team management and have a look at managing human beings, as opposed to managing technologies or hands-on with the technology, becoming a little hands-off. How have you found that from your career perspective?
It was very much a sort of a evolutionary progression for me. I've had a strong sort of focus on continuous improvement since, you know, when I started my career. Don't know where it came from, but it was sort of always there. And sort of as I improved my own skills and tried to improve the skills of the team, the more I learned about the tech, the more I learned that it wasn't about the tech, it was about the people. And that's what really sort of drove me to learn, you know, a bit more about psychology and that sort of stuff, so I can sort of help make the changes to go faster, because a lot of the things that slow us down have got nothing to do with the tech.
Yeah. If you had to provide advice to other people that are maturing in their technology careers and they're trying to decide, hey, do they want to stay hands-on with the tech or move into that sort of more people-focused role, is there any advice you would give to people that want to go down that people route?
Yeah, podcasts, books, learn. I've learned so much about how my own mind works and my own sort of biases and that sort of stuff in the last few years that it's been really informative for me, and I can go, oh, okay, that's why I do that. I'll try not to do that.
If we dig into that a little, do you have any recommendations for people from that people psychology route? Let's start with books.
Books, Influence by Robert Cialdini. That's a really, really good book. Thinking Fast and Slow by Danny Kahneman, or Kahneman, I don't know how to pronounce it. That is an amazing book, and there's so many moments in that book where it was just like, oh, my God, that's so true, and I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Like someone sort of, you know, pulling the blind away from the Wizard of Oz, and you see all the mechanics going on in the background and go, oh,
that's how he does it.
Yeah, it's the understanding of the reasons behind the decision making, right?
Yeah.
Secondary to that, podcast. He's a
On the psychology front, there's Hidden Brain by NPR. That's amazing. Kind of more obscure one is Fall of Civilizations.
Yeah, right.
It's just a random one about, you know, how these sort of big empires sort of collapsed. And I like to sort of see the similarities between what's happening there and certain companies and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I like to do the same thing with autobiographies. I like sport in general, so I like to say, read a lot of autobiographies and see the successful traits between different people and why they've had successes.
Yeah, yeah.
Or autobiographies of, like, one of my favorites, Shoe Dog by Phil Knight, the founder of Nike, and just like to hear all the challenges that they faced in, you know, their growth as well.
Well, another really good podcast for that is Masters of Scale. It's Tales of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tales of Silicon Valley. They're both really good ones about same sort of thing, but about how startups have sort of succeeded and that sort of stuff, how they managed to handle the scale and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, because it's very easy to see those big success stories, right, and think, oh, it's all rosy from the outside. But you start digging into them or you hear the stories of those other civilizations or companies and you find about the challenges that they face on a day-to-day basis. And a lot of these companies are on their last dollar or they had to take a loan out or they're nearly bankrupt and then for something,
yeah.
A little piece
Slack's of Slack's a really good example.
Yeah.
That was an internal tool that they were using, and I think they were developing a game, and basically they ran out of money trying to sell this game and went, oh, let's try to sell this instead.
Yeah. That's phenomenal, right? A little bit of luck. You have a look at Zoom at the moment, you know, and they've benefited. Like they're always a quality product, but
yep.
They are a quality product that had a user base that's grown through a worldwide pandemic that's forced people into using video more.
Yeah.
Right. And they were well positioned to be there. Mm-hmm. So there's an element of luck, though, for them that this pandemic across the world.
There's that, but there was also, it was, you know, sort of one of the best tools available.
Oh, correct. Yeah. 100%. They're not there by complete and utter chance because they had built the quality product and they were, you know, front of mind or the best product in the market.
Yeah.
But then this is fast-tracked by potentially 5 or 10 years.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, on that note, how's the pandemic affected your role, affected your teams? Are you continuing to work remotely now?
Yeah, it's actually been pretty good. When we started the program, there was a lot of focus on the ability to work remotely, especially because we had some team members working from Sydney.
Yeah.
So a lot of effort was put into that. And then, you know, sort of as things started to look really sketchy with COVID, we actually did a trial run. I think it was on a Friday. We just went, right, okay, on the Friday, everyone's going to work from home. And there was a lot of sort of working out the kinks that day, but got it working and it was good. And then I think on the Wednesday was when we all went into lockdown. Mm-hmm. So it was like we'd had a trial run. We'd worked out the kinks. And so it was pretty smooth.
Yeah.
It was... you know, a lot of the parents and the team, including myself, struggled with the kids' remote schooling. That was just love teachers. everyone was like really understanding. And since then, it's been really good.
And you're continuing to work remotely?
Yeah, we continue to work remotely. I'm coming back to office once a week.
Yep.
A few others are doing that. But yeah, most of it's remote work.
What are the tools are you using to help make that a smooth process? Is it, you mentioned Slack, is it?
Yeah. We use a lot of Slack. We use a lot of Zoom. Zoom with screen sharing is great for pairing, that sort of stuff. It's not unusual to find, you know, the fire teams hanging out in a Zoom room, just chatting as they're working on their different parts within the story.
Yeah.
We use Jira for the actual stories. It's a love-hate relationship. We use that sort of for tracking the stories and reporting on them. GitLab for managing the source code and the CI pipelines.
Yeah,
pretty much it.
It's a pretty stock standard stack right there, right? They're all proven products.
Yeah,
they're all, you know, arguably best in breed. So
yeah, and the cool thing about, you know, sort of the data coming out of Jira is that we can go, oh, actually, no, there wasn't much of an impact from COVID for us.
Yeah, productivity is still strong.
Yeah,
yeah. And how have you found mentality of people with working from home? Do you think is there a we're starting to get a little bit of fatigue with it? Do you think it'll be something that'll continue?
Bit of both. I know for myself that, you know, if I was just doing 5 days a week at home, I'd probably be pulling my hair out by now. So I make the effort to come in once a week, but I've got no desire to come in more often if I can avoid it. And yeah, you know, basically everyone's welcome to sort of come back into the office if they feel that they want to, and it's going to work for them. But a lot of people aren't. Like, and today we, on our side of the office where all the devs sit and the fire team sit, we had four people, including myself.
Yeah.
And it's a big team. And they're all just working from home, and we can see the productivity there, and it's great.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's a different approach as well, right? And it's good to see. I think it's just fast-tracked it, I guess, again, for a lot of companies. It's fast-tracked. It's forced us into that.
Yeah.
And then figuring that out as we go.
I think part of it as well, I don't want to harp on about the fire teams, but I think that helps a lot as well.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen other situations in other companies where, as an individual, it's really easy to sort of hide and not be productive, whereas in the fire team, you know, your team's relying on you. Yeah, so everyone's sort of chipping in to get things across the line.
That's really nice. I agree. I think in a small team, you've got accountability, right? As you said, it's not easy to hide. And my opinion is, I think that the people that are in those smaller teams or have that accountability are really thriving in these remote times. And having a mix of that, I think there are, from the conversations I've had around there, there are people that still have that desire for face-to-face or human interaction, whether it be once or twice a week.
Creatures.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Once or twice a week to get in and see some people, have a coffee or just have a conversation. But then having that offset by the ability to work from home and have some flexibility around that, it's really seeing people thrive.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, one of the questions we ask pretty well every podcast guest is their experience with higher education and whether they use higher education to get to their position today. I believe you went to university.
Yeah. So I went to Macquarie University, a Bachelor of Science in Computer Science. Had a fair chunk of electronics in it as well, which was, I think, really helpful because it helped me sort of understand how the software I'm working with actually executes, and a little bit of statistics, which I hated at the time, but I use so often now that I, need to learn more.
Yeah. And what's your opinion on, obviously, university has been a step in your career journey. Is it, in retrospect, is it an important step? What was your experience like?
For me, it was important because it helped get my foot in the door.
Yep.
I'd say you learn so much more in an actual real job that you learn at uni, but at the same time, having that degree opens a lot of doors for you. There's a lot of places where, you know, it's like must have a Bachelor of Science degree, most of the roles that I've seen advertised for the teams I work with say it's a must.
Yep.
I don't necessarily agree with that, but that's just the way it is. But, yeah, I'd say the work experience is far, far, far more valuable. In my last year, I was doing part-time work at CSIRO in AI and learning lots more there.
Yeah, okay. I believe it is a step in the door for some people. A lot of the common answers we get to the question is learning or learning how to learn, learning the ability to learn, having that sort of that capability through university or learning through there has been a stepping stone or something to build upon over time for people. Did you find that experience?
Yeah, probably. I didn't really apply myself very hard during high school and my first year of uni. Took me going away for a year and just having a year off education so that when I came back, I was like, yeah, this is what I want.
Yeah, nice.
I think that was really valuable.
Well, I think that ties back into the way you actually hire for your teams now is knowing what you want. If somebody knows that they want to be a part of your team, they're going to be a better fit. You knowing that you wanted to be at university, you applied yourself more, right? I think that experience there ties in really closely to, you know, your habits today. If you further your education than that, is there informal education that you found really valuable throughout your career?
Yeah, conferences. So the YAO conference, that's sometimes in Sydney, more often not in Brisbane and Melbourne, I found really, really valuable, especially the workshops. Just taking that things that other people are doing in the industry and, you know, sort of bring them into large corporations, which is where most of where I've worked, just it's makes life so much easier. You can go, oh, this is what works. This, whereas in a lot of enterprise organizations, they're very sort of inward focused and like, this is how we do it. And not a lot of focus on improvement. Whereas you can, you know, sort of bring in a tried and tested techniques, tools, approaches, and apply them. And everyone goes, wow, that's amazing. And I'm like, it was me.
Yeah. Conferences. I love this answer. I've got a question for you. Conferences can be, in my opinion, extremely valuable or extremely invaluable, depending on how you operate at a conference. You've obviously been to a few of them. If you had to provide advice to people how to get the most from a conference, what would you say?
Sure.
Yeah.
Basically, first, check out what the lineup is. See if there's something that interests you, then awesome, go to it. If there's stuff that you're half interested in, okay, go to those talks. You might learn something awesome. There's been a few times where I've gone, don't really want to go to any of these, so I'll pick that one, and it's been an amazing talk.
Yeah. And then the networking side of conferences, have you found that valuable, you know, having a conversation with other people or peers in the industry?
Yes, valuable, but not massively so.
Yeah. So it's really the content that you're there for.
Yeah. I go in there like a sponge and try to absorb as much as I can.
Okay. On the sponge topic, we've already mentioned a couple of podcasts and books down that psychology route. There are any other books, podcasts that you would recommend to people?
I have a list. I prepared for this one. So podcasts, we mentioned before, Masters of Scale.
Yeah.
Ambassador Labs, All Things Cloud. It's really good.
Yep.
They have a standard question, which is like, what's your worst developer loop and what's your best developer loop?
Yeah.
Which I really like hearing that, even though it's like every single podcast. I like your podcast.
Thanks.
Tales of Silicon Valley. It's the Week in Tech. I used to listen to and watch a lot, but I've sort of gone off it recently. On the science front, Science Show and Nature are both really good. Psychology, Hidden Brain, Cautionary Tales, Fall of Civilizations. And on the other, the Slash Filmcast.
Nice. Yeah,
that's really cool.
Well, Janae, our video editor and website editor, is going to have a field day finding all of those and linking them up on our website, which they will. They'll be linked up on our website.
Yep. In terms of books, Accelerate by Jess Humble and Nicole Forsgren.
What's that about?
It's basically research on how they found out what high-performing teams were in tech.
Very nice.
It's impressive. Just the science behind it of how they figured it out. It's just like, wow. Continuous Delivery by Jez Humbold and Dave Farley. The Phoenix Project and Unicorn Project by Jen Kim.
Very nice. That's a nice little list. And thank you for coming prepared. Very nice, mate. So it sounds like outside of that, you're obviously a formal education sponge. The last part I think that a lot of people look to, or some people overlook, is mentorship or other people that they can follow. Even if they don't personally know the person, you can follow them and they act like an informal mentor. Is there any people that you've followed or continue to follow that you think have been valuable in your career?
Yeah, lots. So the authors of those books that I mentioned, so they're sort of, you know, sort of look up to them and go, they're awesome. Dan North for his work in behavior-driven development, Aslak Helsoy for his work on Cucumber, which also BDD-related, Jim Weber for REST. So it's funny, a lot of these people, it's like I've actually listened to their talks or done their workshops at conferences and just gone, they're amazing.
Yeah.
They're the ones that sort of jump to mind.
Nice. And is that something you'd recommend? It sounds like you've really bought into that and got value out of, you know, following somebody, listened to their conferences or read their books. That's something you think's been valuable in your career?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I try not to invent wheels.
Yeah.
There's a lot smarter people out there. So it's just much easier to take their stuff and go, it works.
Yeah, nice. The end and wrap it up on the topic of not reinventing the wheel. How do you manage your day? Is there some tools out there you've used, picked off the shelf, and you're like, hey, I use this. It helps me manage my day, helps me be productive.
It's a bit harder for me because, you know, the fight teams have the story backlog and the stories they're working on, and that's really easily managed. There's a backlog, when they're ready to pick up a new story, they'll have a kickoff with the POs and BAs and to understand, you know, what they're looking for, and they just work that story. For me, because a lot of what I do is sort of like filling the gaps in the project or helping the flow, there's a lot of tasks that aren't sort of captured anywhere. So lately, all I do is basically just keep it in Apple Notes. I just basically have a date at the top, list of things that I need to do.
Yep.
As I do them, I tick them off. And the next day, I just copy that list into a new one, change the date, remove anything that's been done, and move forward. And I find that's a good way to sort of just keep track of the little things that I'd otherwise forget.
Nice. Your approach to building teams is a unique one, and I think there'll be a lot of people that are quite interested in that. For people that want to ask you some questions or might want to dig into that or consider doing that for their own teams, you happy for people to reach out to you?
Absolutely. So probably easiest way is Twitter, Tom PA Howard is my handle. Otherwise, you can sort of find me on LinkedIn, but it's a bit boring there. And
you have to deal with too many critters on LinkedIn as well.
Yeah, I know. Tell me about it.
No, mate, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks for providing your insights. For me personally, I found it really interesting to hear about the different approach to building a team. I'm very interested myself in human psychology and why people operate in different ways and how to get more out of performance. So your approach and attacking something differently is very refreshing.
Yeah, cool. Thanks. It's been fun.
Thanks for your time. Cheers.
Thank you.
Listening to this episode of New in Tech People. To stay up to date with all our episodes, our show notes, and past episodes, please visit www.newintechpeople.com.au. Thank you.